Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Tonight on The Readout.
We've got the white Christian men that built this country the first time, and we'll do it again. You think you can replace us? You're wrong. We will replace you.
That is Trump's dinner guest, white supremacist, Holocaust denier, and incel leader Nick Fuentes. Trump claims, implausibly, that he'd never heard of the guy before he served him dinner at his private home. But even after being told who that is, Trump won't condemn white nationalism because of his long history of embracing it. Plus, voter enthusiasm is through the roof in Georgia, with the Senate runoff deadline just 8 days away. Meanwhile, Herschel Walker was MIA for almost a week, and we're still waiting to hear back from him about that debate that he demanded to have with me. What's up, Herschel? But we begin tonight with a very extreme Thanksgiving. In this case, a Friendsgiving meal hosted by Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago with guests Ye, formerly known as rapper Kanye West, and Nick Fuentes, an outspoken anti-Semite and racist who does a podcast popular with fellow anti-Semites and racists from his mother's basement. Here's a sampling of what Trump's dinner guest is all about.
Our secret sauce here, it's these young white men. That's what we call the secret ingredient. America and the world has forgotten about them, but not us.
This is going to be the most racist.
Whoa! Whoa!
Trump has since claimed to know nothing about Fuentes, and he says he didn't know who he was. He obviously does know Ye, who, let's face it, does not appear to have all the chips in his cookie these days, and who must have heard that, you know, Ye's been denounced for making anti-Semitic statements before he invited him over. Trump claims that Ye brought the anti-Semite to dinner, so you know, it's not on him. But he also reportedly said of Fuentes, "I like him. He gets me." Trump dining with a white nationalist? Impossible, according to his campaign, as the meetup descends into a full-fledged public relations catastrophe. One longtime Trump advisor described it as, quote, an effing nightmare. Okay, are we really going to play this game? As if Trump dining with one of the country's most prominent young white supremacists is, like, surprising? Remember, he is the guy who told the far-right Proud Boys to stand back and stand by when he was asked to condemn white supremacists, you know, before they broke into the Capitol. He also said this about the Unite the Right white supremacist rally in Charlottesville that left one counter-protester dead.
You also had people that were very fine people on both sides.
Very fine neo-Nazis, according to Trump. Nick Fuentes was at that rally, along with Richard Spencer, who helped to organize it. Spencer, a prolific and proud white supremacist, Muslim-hating propagandist, attended Duke with Stephen Miller, the architect of Trump's Muslim ban and child separation policies, who now spends his time suing the federal government for helping black farmers. Spencer has publicly stated that he considered himself Miller's mentor. Let's just pause on that for a moment. The person who was writing America's immigration policy was allegedly mentored by an alt-right white nationalist. Oh, and that's Spencer's term, by the way, alt-right, which is basically a cleaned-up word for white nationalist or fascist or Nazi. Steve Bannon, who once bragged that he made Breitbart the home of the alt-right, was later brought on as Trump's chief campaign strategist. He then had a direct line to Trump and the Oval Office, thereby cementing white nationalism and nativism as key components of Trump's national vision. It's like 6 degrees of separation to a white nationalist, and not even six, more like 3 or 1. Then throw in the Republican Party, and it's like, well, everyone knows your name. Two House Republicans, Marjorie Taylor Greene and Paul Gosar, participated in an annual white supremacist event organized by, wait for it, Nick Fuentes. After some backlash, Green claimed, well, she didn't know who white nationalism guy was, despite appearing chummy with him literally on stage. And then we have Matt Gaetz, who hosted Holocaust denier Charles Johnson, brought him as his guest to the State of the Union. Gaetz then claimed that, well, he had no pre-existing relationship with the guy. Just happened to have an extra ticket lying around for the anti-Semite in my office. Ditto on Trump advisor Larry Kudlow, who once invited Peter Brimelow to a birthday party at his home. Brimelow is a promoter of white identity politics on an anti-immigration website called VDare that he founded in 1999. Kudlow said, well, he'd known Brimelow forever, just not the white nationalist part. And there you have it. The same tired excuse we're now hearing from Trump, who denies knowing who anyone is, denies responsibility, you know, denies knowing who David Duke is, but he did know who he is. And behind every one of these denials is something more sinister. This creeping white nationalism and its entry as a central part of Trumpism, which is now just Republicanism, as an alternative but mainstream political philosophy. We've known about this for a very long time. We've said it. We've said it on this show. So let's just stop with the shock and the hand-wringing, the clutching of pearls. Instead, we condemn it. We call it out for what it is. This is another very fine people moment. Very fine people invited to dine in a former president's home. Joining me now, Charlie Sykes, editor-at-large for The Bulwark and MSNBC contributor. Mara Gay, member of the New York Times editorial board and an MSNBC contributor. And Dana Milbank, opinion columnist for The Washington Post and author of The Destructionist, the 25-year crack-up of the Republican Party. I'm going to go in reverse order to the way that I introduced you guys and start with you, Dana. Because the thing is, I think the only thing that surprised me about Trump having dinner with, you know, Kanye used to be a really good rapper, but now it's just, woo, West. And this white supremacist who is the media pretending to be shocked again. How many times are we going to play this game of pretending Donald Trump has not been trucking with white nationalists since he went down that elevator, Dana?
It's so silly, Joy. And I think we owe Trump, in a way, a debt of gratitude here for just coming right out in the open. This isn't the white tablecloth Republican Party. This is the white nationalist Republican Party. We've been talking about the overtones of white supremacy in the party, but it really is now principally the melody. Now, I suppose the good news here is as Trump fades ever so slightly in the Republican Party, he clings more to the fringes. He, you know, plays the QAnon theme music at his rally. He's wrapping himself ever closer with the white nationalists. But the flip side of what's happening here is, who cares why Trump's doing it? It's elevating the white nationalists. It's getting them a national audience over and over again. You know, you mentioned Richard Spencer. When Trump was elected, he said, we have a psychic connection to Trump. And they've had that all along. But it's not just psychic now. There's actually a physical embrace.
There's a physical embrace. And they actually literally tried to overthrow the government for him, Mara. I mean, look, it's not as if white nationalists just popped up when Trump came along. There have been white nationalists in American politics from the very beginning. And there were white nationalists who used to be very much in charge of the Democratic Party. Okay, the Democrats had their turn. They just booted them to the side. Then they became the Dixiecrats. Then they became Republicans. This is not like some magic trick. These people have always been with us. They just keep switching parties. Now that they have control of the Republican Party, I feel like there's this collective sort of amnesia that happens every time Trump does something racist. They go, wait a second. This is a non-exhaustive list. Trump allegedly praised Hitler to Chief of Staff John Kelly during his Europe trip. Vanity Fair magazine claimed that Trump's first wife, Ivana Trump, the late Ivana Trump, claimed he kept a book of Hitler's speeches by his bed. These are old stories from the 90s. Black guys counting my money, said Trump. I hate it. The only kind of people I want counting my money are short guys that wear yarmulkes every day, according to his own ex-employee. I could go on. This guy has a long history going after Japanese people, going after black people. He's been like this the whole time. I don't understand why we play this game of saying, oh, my God, Trump might be racist and anti-Semitic. Get out of here.
Yeah, Joy, I completely agree. And I think and I hope that it's well past time to for all of us, really, to stop obsessing over why Trump is doing the things that he's doing with respect to these white nationalists and how the rest of us have allowed this behavior to go on, have allowed a man who palled around with these people and continues to be in the White House. And I think Republicans in particular, and you heard some of them starting to openly criticize Trump today, especially after those midterms a couple of weeks ago. It's really time for them to have some soul searching, not that we can expect that from them, but really about what they want their party to stand for and where they stand. I mean, every single member of the Republican Party, in my view, needs to be on record. Do you support white nationalism? Do you support Nick Fuentes? I mean, this is really a time for a roll call. I also just, you know, it's hard because we have to wonder, you know, we've always known that these people existed. To your point, Joy, they have always been here. The Klan has been around since redemption. And yet, you know, it's only recently that they are suddenly getting an audience after decades of progress with a former president of the United States. You know, not since maybe Woodrow Wilson have we seen this kind of unabashed hatred from somebody who used to sit in the White House. So that really is in and of itself dangerous because that sends a signal that normalizes this hate and puts a target on the back of any American who is Jewish, LGBT, Black. Just let that continue. So this is a very dangerous moment.
We're going to fix your audio. We're going to come back to you and fix your audio, Mara. But I mean, look, let me go and bring you in here, Charlie. I mean, the media is currently calling the moderate alternative to Trump the guy in Florida who ran against a Black opponent by saying, let's not monkey this up. He's the moderate. The guy in Virginia, Youngkin, who's banning books by Black people. The media actually pretends that's moderate. Let's play somebody actually being asked if they could just straightforwardly denounce Donald Trump meeting with a known white nationalist and Holocaust denier. Here he is. This is a former Trump official. His name is Len Kartakovsky. Here's Don Lemon trying to get him to just say that's a bad thing.
Do you think it was wrong for the former president to meet with Nick Fuentes?
So from what I understand, President Trump said he didn't know Nick Fuentes was coming.
Okay, so you're saying it was wrong for him to meet with him.
Well, you know, again, he didn't know he was coming, but it's never a good idea to give anti-Semites a forum.
It sounds like you're making excuses for him.
I don't think that the president should have met with Kanye or his sidekick, and I wish no one else will either.
You could have said that in the beginning. Thank you very much, Lynn.
Charlie, why was that so hard for why is that so hard for Republicans to do?
Okay, so the first thing to note is that whether or not Donald Trump knew who Nick Fuentes was when he walked into Mar-a-Lago, he certainly knew afterwards, and he has refused to criticize or condemn him, even though he now knows that this is a Jew-hating, Holocaust-denying white supremacist. But and there's a reason for that, and it's the same reason that you're having this other reluctance. It's all about the base. Donald Trump is absolutely convinced that he cannot criticize people like Nick Fuentes because that the racist, anti-Semitic troll base is crucial now to his electoral hopes. And he's communicated that to the rest of the Republican Party. So, you know, there's a reluctance to criticize Donald Trump, but there's a real fear at criticizing the base. And so, you know, what people like Glenn Youngkin and Ron DeSantis are trying to do is talk the Republican Party into moving past Donald Trump, but not ever breaking with that base. And, you know, that's of course, the crisis here. Donald Trump is certainly a problem, but he's also a symptom of something much larger, as you've been talking about. And the reality is that this white nationalist anti-Semitic base has been normalized. It has been empowered in the Trump years. And now other Republicans are afraid that they will split the MAGA base if they break with them. And they're willing to antagonize swing voters and suburban voters, the voters that turned against them in the midterms, because they are reluctant to do what ought to be the easiest thing in American politics, to say that Nazis are bad, anti-Semites are bad, racism is bad, and we condemn them unreservedly. And no, you should not be having dinner with some of the most vile specimens of that of the racist right. The fact they won't do that shows how reluctant they are to confront the real fundamental problem that the Republican Party has right now.
And, you know, Mara, I'm going to come back to you in the middle, because I think it was my idea, not yours. I mean, look, I mean, Hugo Lowell has that exact reporting, right, that Trump didn't want to say anything because he doesn't want to anger the base. But some of them also believe it. Let's just be clear. You know, there's reporting that Ron DeSantis actually was trying to teach Civil War history when he was teaching in Georgia from the South's point of view. So part of it is that they are the base, right? The Tea Party is now the base, and he's one of them. And a lot, these Tea Party people are now the fundamentals of the party. So it's not as if Trump is some sort of outlier. I think that's what we're missing, is that Trump isn't some freak who's dragging the party to the right. He represents the median belief system of many of the people who vote for him. And it's just that simple.
I mean, that's right. We have to kind of go back to the historical origins of the modern day Republican Party, which does not mean that every single Republican subscribes to these beliefs, quite the opposite. But yet the origin of the Republican Party, as we know it today, really has to do with a backlash to civil rights. And so any understanding of that Republican Party without that historical backlash to civil rights is incomplete. And so while, of course, a majority, we hope, of Republicans do not espouse these views, I think we can safely say that, you know, that thread has always been there. And there has always been a tension between the way it is expressed, what's acceptable, you know, what kind of language can we use around it? How close do you get to some of the grosser parts of that base versus just a plain conservative economic agenda? And so that tension has always been there. The difference is that Donald Trump has brought forth an id, if you will, and I'm certainly not the first one to say this, that is really like the darkest face of that.
Yeah.
And I think it's really up to the Republican Party to excise that, confront it once and for all, and move forward. But they do not appear in a position to do so.
And I guess, Dana, that brings us to the question, and I know you get at this in your book, is there anyone with the moral authority among other Republicans to do that? Because it seems to me that when Republicans stand up and try to do that, they get shouted down off the stage. And that's why the Mitch McConnells of the world, who I don't know what he really believes, but he sure ain't going to do anything about this, and neither is Kevin McCarthy.
Well, that's exactly it, Joy. I mean, who is speaking out now denouncing this dinner? Liz Cheney and Asa Hutchinson, you know, future President Asa Hutchinson. And that tells you all you need to know. And it is important, I agree, the historical perspective, because they're, you know, consider Pat Buchanan in 1992 and 1996 is doing the exact same thing that Donald Trump was doing now. Steve King was doing the same sort of thing that Donald Trump was doing now. The difference was there was a critical mass within the Republican Party that stood up and said, no, well, this is not what we stand for, and they marginalized them. So in a way, I think I say, you know, it's good for Donald Trump to finally admit what he is, which is a white supremacist. Where is everybody else in the party now that it's undeniable? Why can't they say, you know, for the obvious reason is that they would be marginalized like a Liz Cheney or like an Asa Hutchinson is going to be if he continues on that path.
And what we'll see in the true character of the men and women of the party is, will someone do it anyway? That's what we're waiting for, is to see who is man enough or woman enough to do it anyway and take the hits like these others who are leaving politics are doing. Let's just see if anybody stands up. Charlie Seitz, Mara Gay, Dana Milbeck, thank you all very much. Up next on The Readout, voters surge to the polls. Just 1 week to go until the Georgia Senate runoff deadline. Readout continues after this.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
We are 8 days away from the final day of voting in Georgia's Senate runoff between Senator Raphael Warnock and Republican Herschel Walker. Today was the first day of statewide early voting after more than 24 counties opted to start over the weekend, including that hard-fought-for Saturday. Turnout has been, quote, blowing the doors off expectations, according to Georgia's Secretary of State. In fact, today set a record for the biggest early voting day turnout in the state's history, with more than 239,000 voters having cast their ballots as of 4:45 p.m. That's in addition to the nearly 157,000 people who voted in person on Saturday and Sunday, following a failed attempt by Republicans to restrict the only Saturday of early voting ahead of the runoff. While Warnock and Walker head into the final sprint, today was the first time Walker has held a public event since last Tuesday. No word from the campaign as to why he's been MIA. By comparison, Warnock held half a dozen events over the weekend alone and has been dominating the airwaves with new ads like this one.
The other night, I was watching this movie called Fright Night, Freak Night, or some type of night, but it was about vampires. I don't know if you know vampires are cool people.
What the hell is he talking about?
Is he serious? Is he for real?
So when China gets all good air, their bad air gotta move.
It's all the same air.
Not only does it make no sense, I don't even understand what he thinks he's saying.
I think it's a risk to me and millions of Georgians to put this man in a position of power.
Let's call it what it is. This is embarrassing as hell.
It's all the same air. By the way, we continue to reach out to Herschel Walker's campaign because we formally accepted his request to come on our show and debate, but we've not heard back. The invitation remains open, Herschel. Come on. Joining me now from Cobb County near Atlanta is NBC News correspondent Tremaine Lee, host of the Into America podcast, and Tia Mitchell, Washington correspondent for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. I'm going to go right to you, Tremaine, because you're talking to the people. What have you heard from voters today?
I'll tell you, Joy, sometimes it's easy to slip into hyperbole and talk about what elections like this actually mean. We talk about those record-breaking numbers. I was at a polling place earlier today where all day long the line was snaking from the door all the way into the street. I spoke to folks like an older woman who said that she feels Herschel Walker is being kind of manipulated like a puppet by the Republicans. Another school teacher who said he sees the stakes too high not to get involved. But also I spoke with this one woman named Miriam. She's a black mother of three, a beautiful little children, who said it's a sense of mission, but also for the future of her children. That's what this election means to her, and this is why it matters that she's involved. Let's take a listen.
As a black woman, knowing that this was not always available to us, I was like, I will do anything I need to do to make my voice heard, exercise my right, and vote for the candidate that I think is going to align with my beliefs and my values. Someone who values the basic right of democracy, the principles that our country was founded on.
The principles that our country was founded on. This, again, it's easy to get into what these kinds of days mean and what early voting means and why it's important for everyone to come out. But these people are mission driven. We also often talk about enthusiasm and excitement. And that doesn't necessarily always mean, you know, cheering with signs. But the folks today standing and voting with their feet and their ballots, they're making their voices heard, Joy.
I'm curious, you know, a couple of issues that I'm wondering if they came up. I mean, this idea, Tremaine, of Walker not really living in Texas. I mean, there was this reporting over the weekend that he files tax returns saying he lives in Texas, but is voting and running for office in Georgia. Did that come up with anybody that you spoke with?
Oh, it came up time and again in the context of what they see as a man who is full of charades and the hypocrisy, whether it's the allegations around providing abortions for his girlfriends or whether it's him liberally living in Texas to take advantage of tax incentives there. It's more of the same. And so when they see the great contradictions between Herschel Walker and Senator Warnock, it's clear, and every single day it becomes more clear.
I'm going to ask you the same question, Tia. Has the campaign responded to that? Because it seems to me that if you can't even prove you live in the state, it kind of makes it all the rest of your claims don't seem to make a whole lot of sense. Has the campaign responded to that reporting?
So we're running into the same problems you cited, where we're not getting a lot from Herschel Walker's campaign. I just wrote an article today about how silent the campaign is on pressing issues. We also aren't hearing a lot from the campaign about his many controversies, including the most recent one about that, the status of his residency and the tax cuts, tax relief he's getting in Texas as a primary resident there. So no, we're not getting much from Herschel Walker's campaign right now. If you're not kind of those conservative media outlets that allows him to stick to his talking points, he doesn't seem to respond. Yeah.
And I mean, we know that he's not said anything about Kanye West and this white nationalist Nick Fuentes dining with Donald Trump. He hasn't said anything about that so far. I wonder if you've been able to ask the campaign, why is it that he can't do interviews by himself? Why does he always have what seem to be minders, white Southern senators who seem to go with him everywhere rather than letting him talk by himself? Has the campaign ever commented on that?
The campaign hasn't. I think what we've heard is that this is Herschel Walker showing his support. That's how they justify it. He's not being handled. He's being flanked by his supporters, you know? And so that's kind of how they put it out there, is that, you know, these are senators that are joining him for these media interviews. But as you've noted, a lot of people kind of interpret it as, again, Herschel Walker is not either not comfortable or not being allowed or not willing to kind of do interviews solo, even on these kind of friendly conservative media networks. He tends to, as of late, do joint interviews with other Republican surrogates with him.
Tremaine, I want to come back to you because you are talking to voters down there. I mean, I've talked to a lot of black men who have said they find Herschel Walker embarrassing. I've played a little bit of the ad that I don't know how heavily it's running on TV in Atlanta and in different parts of Georgia. But have you heard any of that kind of feedback? The idea that he looks to be a representation of black manhood that's humiliating for any black male voters in particular?
Well, that's certainly, if you could hear me, Raphael, Senator Warnock just came behind me. He's on stage now talking. But yeah, I spent the last few weeks here in Georgia today and weeks ago at Morehouse College in particular. And these young men said they see right through the game that they believe the Republicans are trying to play, putting up a kind of a minstrel, right? This false representation of black men and saying, look, we have one of you guys is for us, right? So come on in. And so they quite frankly see it not only as embarrassing, but they see it's part of a broader plan. And it feeds into that narrative that black men didn't want to support Stacey Abrams, that black men weren't involved. And they say this shows clearly how at least the right views many black men.
Yeah. And T, I'll give you the last word on this. We know that President Obama is coming back. What is the campaign saying about the fact that on the Herschel Walker side, they're not going to have Donald Trump, but they are trying to get the Kemp, Brian Kemp, to come out and stump for him? And is he going to do that?
Because
I've heard that he's not on the ads. I've heard that they're sending out paper, you know, sending out mailers that show Kemp, but don't even show Herschel Walker.
Well, yes, the ads that Kemp has cut feature Kemp prominently, not necessarily Kemp with Walker, but Kemp prominently pushing Walker, you know? And again, that message from Brian Kemp has been, you need a Republican in this seat to try to limit what President Joe Biden can do in Washington. Even his message really isn't about Herschel Walker. That being said, no, former President Trump has not been campaigning in Georgia, is not expecting to campaign in Georgia, just like current President Biden has not been campaigning in Georgia and is not expected to campaign in Georgia. So they're sticking to surrogates who they think could help Kemp for Walker, Obama for Warnock.
They're probably worried he'd bring, you know, Ye and Nick Fuentes if he came. I mean, why wouldn't he at this point? Tremaine Lee and Tia Mitchell, thank you both very much. Still ahead. You know, I don't know if any of you guys are old enough to remember back when Republicans thought that crime was America's most pressing issue. I mean, that was like almost a month ago. 24 mass shootings later, and suddenly it's crime? What crime? We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both The Saturday Show and The Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
On the MSNBC podcast, How to Win 2024, political experts former Senator Claire McCaskill and Democratic strategist Jennifer Palmieri examine the campaign strategies unfolding in this all-important election.
The focus is on the voters that are not necessarily in your corner now.
If Democrats are going to win in 2024, we have to be able to explain what is happening at the border and what the solutions are.
Search for How to Win 2024 wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Thursday.
Remember before the midterm elections when Republicans, aided, quite frankly, by much of the media, were all about inflation, gas prices, and crime? They insisted that crime was a top issue for voters, right up there with inflation, and would propel Republicans to a red wave. I mean, abortion, abortion. Well, outside the New York City suburbs, voters did not bite on that narrative. And according to an analysis from Media Matters, coverage of crime plummeted by half on the right-wing echo chamber Fox News as soon as the election ended. Apparently, crime is the 2022 version of Hillary Clinton's emails. There is, however, one type of crime Republicans are not especially interested in, even as it continues unabated, our nation's epidemic of gun violence. In the wake of a series of mass shootings at an LGBTQ club in Colorado Springs and a Walmart in Chesapeake, Virginia, and just a few weeks earlier at the University of Virginia. So, what new gun reform laws can we expect from the new Republican majority in the U.S. House of Representatives? Kentucky Congressman James Comer, in line to chair the Oversight Committee, well, he doesn't see the big deal.
We already have many gun laws on the books. If passing a bill would simply end gun violence, then I think you would have overwhelming support in Congress for that. Number one priority with respect to crime in America for Republicans is going to be the fentanyl crisis.
Joining me now is Shannon Watts, founder of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. You heard him. Thank you for being here, Shannon. If Republicans care so much about crime, why do you suppose that this particular type of crime, crimes committed with guns, seems to be something they have no interest in?
Well, first of all, I think it's very interesting that you would choose the profession of lawmaker if you don't actually think laws work. That's a head scratcher. But, you know, this is the same lawmaker who thinks laws will stop fentanyl death and will stop abortion, but somehow won't stop gun violence. And we simply know that isn't true. You can't be soft on guns and tough on crime. And voters showed Republicans that at the polls, right? Gun safety was one of the top three issues for voters in this country. But the reality is, the data shows gun laws work. When we look at states with stronger gun laws, there's less gun death. When we look at states with weaker gun laws, there's more gun death. That's pretty intuitive. And yet we continue to hear this gun manufacturer rhetoric that somehow more guns and fewer laws are going to make us safer. And if that were true, with 400 million guns and very few laws in this country, we'd be the safest country in the world. Instead, we have a 25 times higher gun homicide rate than any peer nation.
I mean, and I will I brought receipts. The wonderful producers here at the readout got receipts for you to say, just to back up what you said. Six out of the 10 states with the least gun violence deaths have the strictest gun laws. California, Hawaii, New York, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and New Jersey. Mississippi has the least strict gun laws in the country and the highest gun violence rate. The top five states in gun violence in order: Mississippi, Louisiana, Wyoming, Missouri, and Alabama. The United States has 120.5 guns for every 100 people. The next closest country is Yemen, then Serbia, then Montenegro. You go all the way down. And as you said, this is the country with the most murders by far. There is no country that's not at war that has more gun murders. It's the reason it's much more comfortable going to a bar in New York City, where they're not carrying guns, than it is to go in Atlanta, where they can carry in a bar. It seems like it's so obvious. But Republicans go, oh, there's nothing we can do about it. But a lot of states are doing something about it.
Absolutely. And look, this is rhetoric we've heard from the gun lobby, and they've invested in these lawmakers and they're their allies. But slowly but surely, we're making progress, right? When I started doing this a decade ago, about a quarter of all Democrats in Congress had an A rating from the NRA. Today, none do. And in fact, when we passed the first ever federal legislation in nearly 30 years through Congress this summer, It had 15 Republicans sign on. So we have to release the stranglehold that the gun lobby has had on our lawmakers finger by finger, and we're doing that. But, you know, when we look at what is tying these gun deaths in this country together, and let's be clear, it's not just mass shootings, right? It's the daily gun violence that kills 110 Americans. There is something most of them have in common, and that is easy access to guns. We also have something no other country has, and that is a gun lobby that profits gun manufacturers by writing our gun laws to benefit them. It's pretty intuitive, and it's something that all Americans have to get off the sidelines and get involved in. They have a chance a week from Tuesday to re-elect Senator Warnock. And then our legislative sessions start in January. So it's really important that everyone is getting involved in this issue and showing lawmakers they want them to stand on the side of safety.
And very quickly, just comment on there's kind of learned helplessness that I think happens among a lot of voters. I mean, you think about Uvalde County, where this massacre happened about these fourth graders. They voted to reelect the current governor, Greg Abbott, by nearly 22%. The turnout, 45%. Fewer than half of people bothered to vote, and they could have gotten themselves a governor who would have done something about it. That's learned helplessness, Shannon.
It absolutely is. I think cynicism is an excuse too often for inaction. We have to have hope. In those states where we worked hard, you know, Michigan and Minnesota and Pennsylvania, we have flipped chambers of the General Assembly, and now we're going to pass stronger gun laws. We can do that everywhere if we work together to pass stronger gun laws and to vote on the side of gun safety.
Shannon Watts, thank you for all that you do. I appreciate you being here. Appreciate you. All right, up next. Cheers. Growing concerns about possible mistreatment of Brittany Griner and reports that Russia is stonewalling attempts to set up a prisoner swap. More after this. More than 4 months after offering a prisoner swap to free wrongfully detained Brittany Griner and Paul Whelan from Russia, the U.S. is still waiting for a, quote, serious response from Moscow. In the meantime, we are learning more about the horrific conditions Griner is facing after being moved to an IK2 penal colony, essentially a labor camp that's been described as inhumane and slavery-like. Dave Zirin writes in The Nation that not only is the penal colony notoriously racist and utter hell for LGBTQ people, but one activist and member of Pussy Riot, who spent 2 years at a colony, says prisoners are expected to work 16 hours a day, beatings and torture are common, medical care hardly exists, international observers have no idea about Griner's particular conditions, or even if her bed can fit her 6'8" frame. Joining me now is Dave Zirin, sports editor for The Nation and author of The Kaepernick Effect. It's been too long, Dave. It's good to have you on. I want to read a little bit from your column. You write about the right's reaction to the punishment that this woman presumably is enduring. And you write, both the anti-drug law and order crowd and the right-wing cult of Putin and Russia authoritarianism crowd want to see her punished for no other discernible reason than her identity and politics. They point out that Griner protested during the national anthem and wore shirts in solidarity with Breonna Taylor, who was murdered by police in Louisville, Kentucky. Because Griner exercised this speech, she is somehow not really American and somehow worthy of this kind of punishment. Trump insulted Griner, which opens the door for his minions to do the same. As has been said by many, if this was Tom Brady or Derek Jeter in a prison camp for 9 years, the outrage would become an unholy din. I'm just going to let you talk about this case.
I mean, it hurts to talk about this case because Brittany Griner is in a situation that nobody on earth should be in. I mean, if people out there are concerned about the prison system, I mean, you have to be concerned about it in the global context. If you're concerned about the war on drugs, the war on cannabis, people in prison for nonviolent drug offenses, then Brittany Griner needs to be your cause as well. I'm seeing too many people say, well, we have those problems here, so why should I care about Brittany Griner over there, when I think caring about Brittany Griner is actually a part of caring about the problems here at home. So that's what I'm dealing with in terms of like these articles and these ideas on one side of the political spectrum. On the other, we have what you just read. Like, I've actually been shocked, and I've got some calluses, Joy, but I've actually been shocked by the right's response to Brittany Griner's capture. And maybe that's me being naive about the racism, sexism, and homophobia on the right in this country. But I really thought this idea of of an American, an Olympic athlete, somebody who represented this country and has medals on her chest because of it, would at least gain some sort of bipartisan effort at a grassroots level to say, gee, maybe she shouldn't be in jail for 9 years in an act of what is essentially hostage diplomacy. And yet at the same time, we don't have that in this country. We can't even unite on bringing Brittany Griner home. And that is to the deep condemnation of the right wing.
And I mean, I have to assume that Moscow is watching the way that we as a public react to this, right? I mean, at first, we were being advised, don't play it up because we don't want to make her seem more valuable to them. And then when that changed and we're all screaming, bring her home, it seems like we all are looking for you know, how to act. I'm assuming that Moscow can see that there is not a united front behind this athlete and that that influences what they do.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, it doesn't take somebody with a PhD in political science to understand that Vladimir Putin spends as much time studying U.S. domestic politics as it seems like he does studying Russian domestic politics, because he likes inserting himself in our quote unquote culture wars. And he likes the fact that he's an icon to not just the U.S. far right, but to the far right internationally, I mean, for authoritarians the world over. So he wants to play that up, and holding Brittany Griner over the heads of just well-meaning good people in the United States. I don't even want to say liberals or the left. I mean, just people of good heart who want to see her home with her family. Like for Vladimir Putin to see that we can't even agree on that, to him makes Brittany Griner nothing more than a tool by which to tweak the United States. Meanwhile, what we're trying to say is, no, this is a human being. And part of asserting Brittany Griner's humanity, it is also making sure that for our own government, for Antony Blinken and Secretary of State, that freeing Brittany Griner and freeing Paul Whelan be on the top of their to-do list. Because I really do think it diminishes us as a country if we just fold our arms while she suffers.
100%. And it's almost the holidays, the end of the year holiday season. We're fully in the holiday season. So we wish her wife and also Paul Whelan's family and her loved ones very well. And Dave Zirin, I appreciate you. Thank you so much for being here. And up next, good thing Republican governors set up special units to police voter fraud ahead of the recent elections, right? You are not going to believe what they found. I mean, seriously, the big reveal. Straight ahead after this short break. Republicans seem to be incapable of understanding that a majority of Americans don't want them in power. In 2000, even after the Supreme Court gifted them the presidency, they still didn't believe that Al Gore had won the popular vote, claiming that there was widespread fraud that flipped states like New Mexico for Gore. That and other Democratic wins led to Republican Attorney General John Ashcroft announcing a nationwide initiative for the country's 93 U.S. attorneys to combat voter fraud. As it turns out, they didn't find much of anything, mostly minor stuff. But they were so hell-bent on finding this mythical voter fraud that they actually fired 7 U.S. attorneys in a single day, in addition to one who'd previously been fired, an unethical move that ultimately led to the demise of Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez's tenure. But that primed the Republican Party just perfectly for Trump, who, even though he won the presidency, couldn't handle the fact that he lost the popular vote by 3 million votes. So he set up an entire voter fraud commission. And surprise, surprise, there was no widespread voter fraud. Same deal in 2020, though there were MAGA voters in the villages who voted for Trump twice. But Trump's inability to admit defeat in 2020 led to the creation of multiple law enforcement units, paid for by taxpayer money, of course, and in Florida, some very grossly staged arrests of black voters who had felony records but were led to believe that they could vote. And guess what? Those units found absolutely nothing in these midterm elections either. But this has never really been about finding voter fraud, has it? It's been about Republicans making it as hard as possible for Americans to vote against them. And Republicans are going to keep trying it as long as they keep losing. And that is tonight's readout.
Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at msnbc.com/win.